I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, the hunt for student loans and summer reading for college students. But first, the role religion continues to play in this year's presidential race. Tomorrow, the two presumptive presidential candidates, Senators John McCain and Barack Obama, will be at Saddleback Church in California. That's the mega church of Pastor Rick Warren, author of the best-selling book, The Purpose-Driven Life. Warren is considered the most pivotal figure in U.S. evangelism. His book is the best-selling nonfiction hardback book in history, aside from the Bible. Rick Klein is senior political reporter for ABC News. And Rick, first of all, what's the significance of this event at Saddleback Church?
This is the first time that Barack Obama and John McCain will share a stage in the general election. Even though they won't have a debate and they'll be on the stage separately, they will at least meet. And they're going to face the same questions, essentially, from Rick Warren. Rick Warren has even said that John McCain is going to have to stay in a soundproof cone for the first hour so that he can't respond to anything that Barack Obama says, to make it utterly fair, like an old game show. The subject is important as well. The issues of important to religious voters are critical for this election. John McCain has a lot of trouble with this particular type of voter, evangelical white Christians, more trouble than George W. Bush did. And George Bush was able to put this coalition together in a way that Barack Obama is challenging very directly. And this Rick Warren Forum is a key part of that.
So tell us about some of the issues they're expected to talk about with Rick Warren.
The key issues that are often important to members of the evangelical community, abortion, gay rights. I think we'll also hear a lot about the personal relationship that both candidates enjoy with their religion, and that should be interesting. This is not, in either case, a candidate who is comfortable with it fully. However, they both are pretty religious people. So to the extent to which they describe that will be fascinating. And of course, whenever we talk about Barack Obama and his church, Trinity Baptist, and the controversial minister, Reverend Wright, that'll be something to watch as well, how he handles any probing in that direction.
Now, you mentioned the trouble that McCain is having with evangelical voters, and I think the polls are showing that a majority of evangelical voters support McCain over Obama, but they're really not enthusiastic. On Good Morning America today, Pastor Warren was asked if he thinks that that's fair.
I think it's fair. I think a lot of evangelicals don't see Barack Obama as one of their own. Many evangelicals think neither of these guys are evangelical.
So that's the bottom line, isn't it, Rick, that this vote is up for grabs?
It's not entirely up for grabs. The vast majority of white evangelicals will vote for John McCain. But the polling suggests it's about a 10-point lag behind where President Bush was in the 2004 election. That's the difference in an election right there. And another interesting side note on this is John McCain has been publicly flirting with possibly naming Tom Ridge or Joe Lieberman to his ticket. Both of them consider themselves, quote-unquote, pro-choice on abortion. That would really alienate a ton of evangelical voters out there, people that are already disappointed in his candidacy would have another reason to stay home.
So who do you think has the most to gain from this appearance? Some folks say, you know, it's an advantage for any Democrat to be at this mega church event. Do you see it like that?
I think that's generally right. I think given what he is trying to do with religious voters and the Democrats have tried to do since 2004 and trying to attract evangelicals, although I wouldn't discount the advantage to John McCain. His views do align more closely with Pastor Warren, and so I think that's one thing. And I also think he has gotten better in recent weeks and months at talking about the personal side of his faith.
And why don't you explain to us a little bit who Rick Warren is, for people who don't know? I mean, his story is really amazing, and you know, it's amazing how it got to this point that the first joint appearance of the presidential candidates are going to be at his church this weekend at a you know, really critical time in the whole campaign process. Who is he, and what does this mean exactly, not only for the candidates, but for U.S. evangelicals?
Well, to get a sense of his influence on this, the way that he invited Barack Obama and John McCain to this debate, he called them both directly on their cell phones. He had both of their numbers. I don't know of anyone else in the country, maybe outside the United States Senate, who's able to do that. Rick Warren leads a 22,000-member megachurch, Saddleback Church, in Orange County, California, that's really become sort of the epicenter of a lot of thinking among evangelicals. What he's been able to do, though, in terms of driving the debate forward, he is not so closely aligned with the religious right, or for that matter, the religious left, that he's unable to be an appropriate mediator. If this was someone who was, you know, known as a foot soldier on the right, then there's no way Barack Obama would show up for a forum like this, and likewise in the other direction. So he ends up playing a bigger role even than we could have anticipated in the politics. There is no single figure whose image looms larger over the nexus of evangelical Christianity and politics than Rick Warren.
So So do you think that what's also going on here is that there's a shift in the evangelical movement?
There's a shift, particularly among younger voters, and also among a lot of folks who just frankly gotten sick of where they've seen the Republican Party take things. The environmental degradation that's happened over the last few years, you can even lump it in a sense with the runaway spending that's happened on things other than things that quote-unquote Jesus would care about. The lack of commitment by the Republican Party to some of the welfare programs, to helping poverty, that sort of thing. I do think there's a lot of folks inside the evangelical community have reexamined their relationship with politics, and they're ready for at least looking at a change. Now, John McCain's challenge is to keep them in the fold after 8 years of a Republican who really was one of them. And Barack Obama may be uniquely situated to reach out to them, although there is a big pushback against that. A lot of folks still think he's a Muslim, wrongly, of course. His association with Reverend Wright has been controversial. He is a religious man, but it's not something that you associate with him directly.
Mm-hmm. And also, before the upcoming convention, we did find out that Senator Hillary Clinton's name will be placed in nomination at the Democratic convention. And it's being described as a symbolic gesture to unify the party. What do you think? Is this a problem?
I think it potentially is a problem. This is just going to ensure that an extra portion of the convention essentially belongs to the Clintons and not to Barack Obama.
Rick Klein is senior political reporter for ABC News. He also writes The Note for the network's website. We'll link you to it on our website. Rick, thanks very much.
Thank you.
The credit crunch is making it harder for thousands of college students to pay their tuition bills for the upcoming school year. Dozens of private banks are getting out of the student loan business, meaning they will no longer provide private loans that supplement federal aid. Right now, about 900,000 students seek those private loans, and according to FinAid.org, about 200,000 of them won't be able to get them. Here in Massachusetts, the State Educational Financing Authority suspended all of its lending, forcing 32,000 borrowers to go to private banks with higher interest rates. For more, we turn to Gail Marks Jarvis, a personal finance columnist for the Chicago Tribune. And Gail, we spoke with you earlier this year when we first heard about the student credit crunch, and now the bills are due. What's happening?
Well, what's happening now is that students who are going to find the loans that they thought they could get are finding out that those loans are a lot harder to get, and especially if they need money that goes beyond the limits that they're allowed on the federal student loans, which are Stafford loans.
And what are the limits on the federal loans?
Students can borrow, for example, the first year $5,500 at a 6% interest rate, which isn't bad.
But the average tuition bill is tens of thousands.
That's where the problem lies, because in the old days, students could get private loans, but a lot of those lenders have now gone out of business, and so you may not be able to get a private loan if, for example, you have bad credit or your parents have bad credit.
So what are the interest rates like on some of these private loans on average?
It wouldn't be surprising for the interest rate to be around 12%.
And that's 12% compared with the 6% interest rate on the federal loans. But some students have had to turn to private loans to make up the difference between tuition and the $5,500 limit on some of the federal loans. So is that where we're seeing the biggest effect, Gail, with these private loans?
That's exactly where people are having problems. The federal loans are okay. The federal plus loans are also okay. Those are the loans that parents can get. So what I would suggest is if a student's going to college, that they first get the maximum federal loan that the student can get, then the parents get the maximum plus loan. But the trouble is that if the parents don't have good credit, they may not get a plus loan. In that case, the student has to look for a private loan, and that's where things run into trouble.
Do you expect that there will be a great number of kids who won't be able to enroll in the school they expected to this fall?
I think if you're going to a public college or a major private college and you can finance this through federal loans, you're not going to have any problem. But a lot of students go to what are called career colleges, colleges that maybe prepare them for culinary future or maybe a dental hygienist. A lot of the students that go to those, they've been working for a while, they may have families, perhaps they don't have the perfect credit, then those people could have a major problem finding the private loans that they need to go beyond the federal loans that they can get.
You know, it sounds as if some sort of a policy change might be in order. I know that the government did increase the amount that students could borrow on these federal loans to the $5,500. But also, maybe, are there other things, you know, that the government should be taking on? Maybe looking at increasing the amount students can borrow based on the family income that's filed in their federal financial aid forms, or some other kind of policy change that might help?
The real cure for this is going to come through the private markets. The federal government can't possibly finance all of this. And the reason this all occurred is because the private student loans have been available the same way mortgages are available. Lenders give loans, and then they bundle up all those loans and they sell them to investors in the form of bonds. And that's called securitization. And when investors got nervous about mortgages, they gave up investing in any of those kinds of bonds. And until that business comes back, lending for student loans is going to be crippled. And I've spoken to college financial aid people. They're well aware of this. They say they can get by perhaps until the spring or summer. But after that, there is going to be trouble.
So would you say that come January or next fall, it's likely that this picture may be even more grim?
Yeah, what's happening now is some of the colleges are stepping forward and providing lower interest loans to students so that they can attend this year. But there's a limit to how far colleges can go with that. And if the old market that I referred to as securitization, if that doesn't reopen, the colleges tell me they're going to be in a big bind.
So main pieces of advice to students and families trying to figure out how they're going to pay tuition right now, it would be go to a school's financial aid office and make sure you exhaust your federal loan possibilities, and then what?
Absolutely. Make sure that you don't get discouraged by what you're hearing right now and assume that you can't get a loan. That's my biggest worry. So they need to go to their college financial aid office. They need to see if they can get more federal loans than they thought. There may be some state loans that they can get. If they're low income, they might be able to get a larger Pell Grant because the federal government did provide some money for additional Pell Grants. These are grants for people with relatively low incomes. After that, then they need to ask about private loans. And if the lender that the student was dealing with before is no longer in business, the college will be able to perhaps suggest another lender. And if not, the student should say to the college, I'm in a bind here. I can't do this. Is there some other help? And in that case, the college may say, yes, we can provide you a loan too.
Gail Marks Jarvis writes a personal finance column for the Chicago Tribune. Gail, thanks very much for speaking with us.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it.
And just ahead, summer reading for incoming college freshmen. Later in the show, is Pakistan's president about to step down? We'll be back in a minute. It's Here and Now. We just heard about how some college students are struggling to pay their tuition bills, but not all of their attention is on money. An increasing number of colleges are implementing summer reading programs, or common reading, for all incoming students. The list of books assigned to the class of 2012 is diverse. At Northern Kentucky University, students are reading Love My Rifle More Than You. That's Kayla Williams' memoir about being a woman in the U.S. Army. At Albion College in Michigan, they're reading Thank You for Smoking, Christopher Buckley's novel that inspired the movie about a tobacco lobbyist. On the line with us are three faculty members involved in college summer reading programs. Jill McKinstry is the director of the Undergraduate Library and on the Book Selection Committee at the University of Washington in Seattle. Welcome, Jill.
Thank you very much.
Also with us is Dr. Roger Callanan. He's the Assistant Dean of the Division of Undergraduate Academic Programs at North Carolina State University in Raleigh, North Carolina. Welcome, Roger.
Thank you for providing this opportunity.
And Bo Breslin is a professor of government, and he's head of the first-year program at Skidmore College in Saratoga Springs, New York. Welcome, Bo.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about summer reading for the class of 2012 right now. And Professor McKinstry, let's start with you. At the University of Washington in Seattle, what are you asking incoming freshmen to read?
We're asking them to read a book written by Luis Alberto Urrea called The Devil's Highway. Urrea took about a year in studying an actual event that happened in 2001 when 26 Mexican immigrants came across the border in Arizona. And not all of them made it. And it is an amazing ability to bring a human perspective to these very difficult issues of immigration.
So what were you looking for then in choosing a common read for all students? Was it something that was very compelling, very topical? I mean, do you have a set of criteria that you try to look at when you're choosing a book for incoming freshmen?
We do have a set of criteria, and it's evolved each year. We try to get a little better at it, but I think it's always a sticky process. It's difficult to hit it right, particularly when you are handing it out to over 5,000 freshmen and asking them to read it on their own over the summer. But what we tried to make sure that it was accessible, that it was readable, that it stimulates good discussion. Also, it's hopeful that it can be integrated into the academic program.
This is required of all freshmen, regardless of their majors, correct?
Yes. At large research universities, it's pretty common that not all students have one class they all take in common. So we have something called the Freshman Interest Group program here, in which I think about 70% of the students are involved in that. But there's no one class where we can be assured.
Mm-hmm. Let's move over to the East Coast now. Professor Callahan, what about at North Carolina State University? What is the summer reading requirement there for incoming freshmen?
The associate deans have chosen Sounds of the River by Da Chen. Now, what's interesting is that last year, the associate deans chose the first autobiographical book, the precursor to this one, by the same author, by Da Chen. That was Colors of the Mountain. Part of what we do is not just have the reading, but we look for the opportunity to bring the author in as well. And we were so moved by his presence on our campus last year, so he could have written anything as a follow-up, and we would have wanted him here, I think. I have to say that one of the things that was compelling, too, and is really probably only dawning on us most in current time, is it really has exposed us to the Chinese culture, historically as well as present day. And with the Olympics going on right now, that has really, I think, piqued the interest of the students and the faculty, as we have a rare opportunity for some insight into a culture that has been distant.
Professor Breslin, Skidmore College decided to take a different route this summer, and you chose a CD required of incoming freshmen. Why was that?
We decided to go a little bit of a different route this year for a couple of reasons. Our sense was that, you know, sort of the monopoly of books as summer reading didn't cover, obviously, a lot of the ways in which people communicate. So we decided to assign Terrence Blanchard's CD, A Tale of God's Will, A Requiem for Katrina, partly because of the fact that we want to expose students to non-traditional texts. We also have supplemental readings, though, that help sort of put Blanchard's CD in context. So we have six articles, poems, the White House report on Katrina. We only have 650 incoming students, but we still have trouble with classes having some connection to the reading. And the idea behind Blanchard's CD and the supplemental readings was that, think of the different ways in which classes could tap into it. You know, geography of the region, death of a city, class issues, race issues.
And the CD, we should say, won a Grammy for Best Large Jazz Ensemble Album.
It did.
So students are listening to a little bit of music there, but they're also supplementing their listening, Bo Breslin, with some other reading. And that's all required of them as well, including
yes,
the White
is.
House report on Hurricane Katrina and all those other things. Okay, so they're not getting off easy.
No, they're not getting off easy. The idea was that we could take a little bit of a step into this pool and be a little risky with the summer reading, but we couldn't go fully in. I mean, the reality is we're constantly trying to get students to learn how to read, too.
Why are we doing this now? Should it have been done sooner?
We're starting to get a better sense of what it means to be a first-year student. I think colleges are much more intentional about recognizing the unique challenges of the first year. And as a result, we're looking for additional ways for students to have that common experience.
Bo Breslin, professor of government and the head of the first-year program at Skidmore College in Saratoga Springs, New York, thank you.
Thank you.
And Jill McKinstry is the director of the Undergraduate Library and co-chair of the Book Selection Committee at the University of Washington in Seattle. Thank you, Jill.
Thank you so much.
And Dr. Roger Callanan is the assistant dean of the Division of Undergraduate Academic Programs at North Carolina State University in Raleigh, North Carolina. Thank you very much, Dr. Callanan.
Thank you. This has been educational for me, too.
And still ahead, is Pakistan's President Pervez Musharraf going to resign? And if he does, what will that mean for the United States and its hunt for al-Qaeda? Also, is Google Street View crossing the line in Japan? Some Japanese think it's getting too close to people's private lives. We'll be back after the news. It's Here and Now. I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. News reports today say Pakistan's President Pervez Musharraf could resign in the next few days. Musharraf's been under political pressure at home since last year when he dismissed the country's judiciary and imposed emergency rule. The recently elected government is preparing impeachment proceedings against him. Pakistan is a strong U.S. ally, and Washington is concerned about the stability of Pakistan, which the White House increasingly sees as the key battleground for defeating al-Qaeda and the Taliban. With us in studio is Adil Najam. He's professor of international relations and director of the Pardee Center at Boston University. Professor, welcome back.
Thank you.
First, tell us, a spokesman for President Musharraf is denying that there's going to be any resignation. How credible are these reports of Musharraf stepping down?
I think what is very credible is that there are serious discussions about the possibility of his stepping down, and it is much more than just simply likely that he will decide to step down. The political parties, the political government have kind of... The strategy they have adopted has been very successful. Three out of the four provincial parliaments have now passed resolutions asking for his impeachment. It seems that the political parties have the numbers in the parliament to do that. Neither the military, nor Musharraf, nor the U.S. would like to see this battle being drawn out and him kind of being humiliated.
In impeachment.
Mm-hmm. Right? It wouldn't be good for the military. It wouldn't be good for one of our closest allies as a person, for the U.S. So all his backers are kind of moving back and saying maybe this is the time to leave. What they're trying to find is whether there is a so-called safe passage, some departure with some modicum of dignity. Yeah. I think the political parties themselves wouldn't mind that.
Mm-hmm. So what would a deal look like then for safe passage for Musharraf?
I think part of it will be some sort of an amnesty. It would probably look not different from the type of deals that Pinochet in Chile and others have had before. Part of it will be an actual passage to someplace else, both for his personal physical safety, but also because as soon as he drops the office of the president, all sorts of people will take up all sorts of case in the judicial battlefield. And Pakistan is a hot judicial place right now for treason, for these peoples who have disappeared, for deals with the U.S. and so on and so forth. So Musharraf probably doesn't want to go through that. The military doesn't want him to go through that. The U.S. doesn't want him to go through that. So that will be part of a deal. Some sort of an amnesty, probably a move somewhere else. The place being mentioned most right now is Turkey. My own sense is it might not be Turkey. It could be a place like Dubai or somewhere in the Gulf, or it could be the U.S.
Hmm. And then what would the government get in return?
I think a little respite from this constant bickering. Hmm. And then we are going to see the government, which is really united by their common dislike for General Musharraf, coming to grips with their own differences, which are quite great. So someone said the other day, which I think is quite a pertinent comment, that it is not clear at all that Musharraf's departure will make things any better. but it is likely that it will keep them from getting worse.
So what happened? Where did all of this dislike for Musharraf come from?
I think it came from an arrogance in his part that grew out of being in office for too long, and an impatience on the part of the rest of the country from seeing him there too long and not seeing enough results. I think it started certainly with the judicial crisis, but before that with the killing of this tribal leader called Nawab Akbar Bukti in Balochistan about 2 years ago. I think that was the beginning of the end for Musharraf. But here's the thing, what happened. I think when Musharraf came, he had a modicum of support, not because people liked him, but they really thought that the political parties were not good. That hasn't changed. They have now realized he's no better. So, and that leaves Pakistan in a very bad place. This does not mean his people are relieved. I think a lot of people will be relieved, but not necessarily happy at his departure, because what is left behind will still be, for quite a while, a big mess. But hopefully it will be a better mess.
And this is almost a cycle in Pakistan, isn't it, for some of the democratically elected governments?
Not almost. This is the Groundhog Day, 60 years of Groundhog Day. There are only three ways in which people leave power in Pakistan, the three dreaded Ds. There's death, Ziaul Haq. There is detention, Nawaz Sharif. Or there is disgrace, Benazir Bhutto. One guy is Zulfiqar Ali Bhutto, took all three together. Unfortunately, we haven't had any experience in someone leaving power through a normal democratic way. And therefore, the traditions and habits of democracy haven't set in. People have to realize that democracy is a messy thing. And that's really the tragedy of Pakistan politics.
Who do you think is his likely successor if he does leave?
There's a lot of speculation on that. A lot of people think that Asif Ali Zardari, the widower of Benazir Bhutto, head of PPP, and really the de facto ruler of Pakistan today, might take that office. My own sense is that that may not happen. He might actually like to play the Sonia Gandhi role in India, sitting from the back and making things work, which he has for the last half year now. And therefore, it may be possible that a figurehead president is placed, someone who the military has some confidence in, and the U.S. has some confidence in. Now, here's the thing. The president technically does not have too many powers. And so the powers he has, Musharraf took on himself. The president in Pakistan has very few powers to do anything, but a lot of power to make things bad for others, meaning he can revoke the parliament, call new elections. But the government is supposed to be run by the prime minister. And so that's going to be a big question.
And what about in terms of the U.S. and its relationship with Pakistan? I mean, what happens?
I think what the big surprise in the U.S. will be that nothing will happen, meaning that things will remain as they were. They will become no better and no worse. And I think this myth that General Musharraf had himself created, that somehow he was central to the Pakistan-U.S. relationship, is going to be shattered. And what we will find and are already finding is that any government in Pakistan, military, civilian, no matter who it is, will do what he was doing, but will not be able to do any more than what he's doing.
And what about the U.S. goal to try to rid Pakistan of militants?
I think that's much more of a Pakistani goal than a U.S. goal right now. The U.S. is only concentrated on militants on one border. Pakistan itself, you know, with bombs going every day. I think there the difference is one of strategy, and it will remain. Neither will Pakistan nor the U.S. have any idea of what strategy will work. They have preferred strategies. Both have failed. And I think that tension will remain. Part of, I think, the irony here is that the U.S. would like Pakistan to be able to control this area, which is really not controllable. For the same reason why we can't do too much in Iraq, the government of Pakistan, which is much weaker, much, much poorer, much fewer resources, can't do a terrible amount in that area. So I think that dynamic will remain until Pakistan, the U.S., and Afghanistan come up with a real credible strategy to do something about it.
And if he does go, where might Musharraf go?
Don't be surprised if you find him here in the U.S., interviewing him sometime very soon.
All right. Well, Adil Najam, Professor of International Relations and Director of the Pardee Center at Boston University, thanks for being with us. And before we go today, we'll hear the story of Norman Porter. Was he a model citizen or a hardened killer or both? You're listening to Here and Now. The internet search engine Google debuted a new feature last year known as Street View. It gives users panoramic photographs of actual life at street level in many major urban areas. And since last year, Google's Street View has expanded. It's now in dozens of U.S. cities and some other countries. But in Japan, Street View is running into some problems. Critics charge that the photos are an invasion of privacy. One Japanese blogger wrote a letter to Google asking that pictures of residential streets be removed. Chris Salzberg is Japanese language editor at globalvoicesonline.org, and he's been following this story. And Chris, how widespread would you say is the view that Google Street View has overstepped its bounds and it's allowing too much of a view?
It's hard to kind of gauge what the majority is because I've been reading some stuff and it's pretty split actually, which is interesting. But there's definitely a large number of people who see it and immediately feel uncomfortable about it. What's interesting I found is some of the comments in Japan have been about, for example, Street View catching people's clothes on the line, because in a lot of urban centers, people are very close together and people put their clothes out of the line. And you can see all this stuff. If you walk down the street, you can see people's underpants and stuff out there. And people just don't look at it, or they're not supposed to look at it. But when you have Street View, suddenly it's there. It's permanently there. And so you can go and you don't have to worry about anybody seeing you, seeing them.
Also, Chris, some critics are saying that the design of cities in Japan is something that's different from what we have here in the U.S. Can you explain that a little bit more?
The interesting thing is that in Japan, a lot of houses, they've kind of walls around their building, and the walls are actually not that high. So I'm quite tall, and I can peep over them if I try. But what happened is when this Google van comes by, the camera is actually quite high. So you can actually see over the walls into people's houses. You know, some of these bloggers were showing pictures where you can see stuff a normal person would never be able to see from eye level. The people who are criticizing Google say that they should have realized this before they just rolled the whole thing out.
There have been lawsuits over Google Street View here in the United States, and there are folks who have various concerns about whether it's an invasion of privacy or whether it might even be dangerous in some cases for children or things like that. I mean, is it similar, would you say, or is there something different about the argument over this in Japan?
One thing is that there were a lot of comments because this conversation went from Japan and then was picked up in the States, and a lot of people in the States and other places also were saying that this is not a Japanese issue, this is a worldwide issue, and, you know, it's all universal issues. And that was one of the points, was that there have been a lot of objections, not only in Japan. And in Japan, in terms of the danger issue, a lot of people point out, for example, that with Street View you can go by somebody's house, and again, with the clothes out on the line, you can tell if there's a woman in living in the place, and if she's, you know, a single woman, you can kind of tell from the appearance of what kind of clothes are on the line, and then you know a stalker or somebody could target a particular house. Or the other one is, if somebody wants to rob a house, they can get a really nice view of the house, and as I said before, if you can see over the wall, that helps you also in preparing or something. So those kind of issues have brought up, which I think are not so different from what's happening other places.
Now, Google, in Street View, can blur faces and license plates. People can request to have images removed. And Google, of course, has said, you know, we respect people's privacy, and things can be flagged and instantly taken down, so they're not viewable. Is that not enough?
I guess the objection would be that faces are not enough. I mean, again, the issue is really that they kind of do something, and then after it's done, then they start pulling back. So we do all the streets, and then people can then say, I don't want this, and then they pull it back out. And that might not work in this particular case. So you can't tell people, we're going to film your front street and everything, and then after, if you don't like it, you can come to us, and then we'll remove it. What they're saying is that on the web, that's fine, but in the real world, maybe that's not the right approach.
I wonder if any of this is because Google is not a Japanese company. Do you think there's some of that going on?
It was kind of interesting. There were some people who were asking, like, did the people at Google Japan not think that this was going to bring up objections? Because it seems to be kind of obvious that if you look at Street View as a Japanese person, that there are going to be people who are not going to like this. And yet they just did it, it seems, without doing that much preparation. And the funny thing is that in Japan, I mean, Google kind of needs to be, I think, it needs to be kind of careful in Japan, because Yahoo is still by far the dominant search engine in Japan. And Google has had a hard time pushing them out or finding much room there. So to me, this seems like not a very strategically well thought out move from what I'm seeing right now.
Chris Salzberg is Japanese language editor for globalvoicesonline.org. Coming up, a documentary about a man who lived as a poet and church leader after he escaped from prison. It's Here and Now. For many years, Norman Porter was the most wanted fugitive in Massachusetts. He was convicted of killing a man during a robbery in 1960 and killing a prison guard while trying to escape from jail in 1961. Porter remained in prison until he escaped in 1985. 20 years later, police finally caught up with Porter. He was living in Chicago under the name J.J. Jameson, and he was known there as a poet and a church leader who helped create daycare centers. Norman Porter's double life is the subject of a new documentary called Killer Poet. It includes interviews with Porter's supporters and detractors and with Porter himself. Here, he talks about his poetry and reads some of his poem, Thoreau's Grave.
Poetry does not come with the writing. Poetry comes with the reading. There's no poem worth reading if you can't steal a line or two. So with my past as being a thief to begin with, I figured I'd steal a line or two and write some poetry. Walking across Thoreau's grave in winter, feeling the cold of 2 years at Walden Pond, I recount the $28.12 in my pocket, deep in my pocket. My arms feel like they belong to my ancestors.
That's Norman Porter reading his poem Thoreau's Grave from jail in Massachusetts. We spoke with the movie's director, Susan Gray, and asked how she would describe Porter.
Cantankerous, charming, funny, very intelligent, very quick-witted. I'd say he has a loose hold on the truth. He sort of lives his life now in memories that are gone or stories that he's woven. So it's always hard to know where the truth ends, you know, and the lies begin. But I'd say he's really a character, very charming.
Hmm. You know, in one part of the film, he says, "I just want to be forgiven."
That's a big moment in the film. That was a big moment in actually making the film. I like to tell stories the way I discover them. And I had gotten to know Norman first as Norman the Killer, because the first people we talked to were the victims' families. And then we went to Chicago, and I got to know Norman the Poet. You know, and the poet was a very good man, and the killer was a very bad man. And what the people used to say about him was, Norman doesn't show any remorse. He is quite proud and arrogant, and I didn't see a lot of remorse when I spoke to him. And then we were interviewing his teacher, who had actually published a book of poems of prisoners at Norfolk Prison. And he found it. He was going through his cupboards while I was interviewing him, and he found this book, and he pulled it out, and he said, "Oh, here's a book of poems, but there's some Norman in here." And he started reading that poem.
It pains me every time I remember that second. I see the guy I killed. I drank with him once down at the Lynn Tap and Grill. We got away that night, but they caught the guy driving the car, a nice brand new four-door Buick I stole over in front of the Lafayette House. He just couldn't wait to tell all he knew. Soon the police were after us. We wound up getting caught and pleading guilty to murder and robbery to spare the horrors of the electric chair. I've lived every minute of every day of every year, whether I wanted to or not, with that one bad frame staring me right in the face. I don't want justification or even that elusive legal justice. Just want to be forgiven.
I felt personally, here is the pain and here's the remorse that he doesn't show in his public life. And I've spoken to his attorney since. They said it took him 4 years of counseling and therapy before he could write that poem.
Hmm. And at the same time, your film talks with family members of some of his victims and certainly some state police officials who feel that he not only killed people, but then he lived on the run for 20 years. So he was free and he really should stay in prison, and that's where he belongs.
I think it's really important to understand both sides of the argument. I mean, it's not, some people we were looking for funding said, why didn't you pick a guy who was more obviously good, somebody who didn't commit the crime and had been stuck in prison for 20 years, not having committed the crime? And Norma Porter is a more interesting case because it shows the complexities of justice in deciding what's right and what's wrong. You talk to the victims, and it's as though the the ones who were still involved, there are many of the victims who are no longer involved in the case, but the ones who still are involved feel the pain today as though it had happened yesterday. So it's very important to know that that's what's keeping them in prison, and that's what makes this complicated. But on the other hand, Norman Porter went through the system at a time when it was right after Attica, and we were really working on rehabilitation in this country, especially in Massachusetts. And the promise was made to him that if he was rehabilitated, if he got an education and he got skills and he changed who he was, that he would eventually be let out. And I think Norman really believed that. And the people who knew him in prison are real advocates and say he was an outstanding prisoner. He became sort of the poster child for rehabilitation. But because of politics, he was never let out. So he really felt as though the system had failed him. And that's when he took justice into his own hands and escaped, which then complicates the picture.
Right.
Because now he has escaped, and escaping is very serious, you know. And should politics be involved in our system? You know, was Norman taking the law into his hands because the system wasn't working? Are we just warehousing prisoners? Will we ever allow prisoners to be rehabilitated and leave prison? I mean, these are all the issues that are raised by his case.
The hearing that was held right before he did escape was with then-Governor Michael Dukakis.
He was actually, his sentence was commuted, and he should have left 26 years ago. Actually, both sentences were commuted for both murders. But there's a sort of a vestige of the colonial days left in the state of Massachusetts. It's the governor's commission that sort of rubber stamps everything a governor does. And they wanted to punish Dukakis, and so they never acted on it, and they never let Norman out, even though his sentence was commuted. So he really was locked into the political, you know, never-never land for a long time before he escaped.
Now his detractors say that he's very manipulative, and you say he's very intelligent, but he has sort of a loose grasp on the truth. How did you make sure that he wasn't manipulating you?
Oh, I'm sure he was manipulating us.
Yeah.
I mean, he's charming. He turns on the charm.
Mm.
It was funny because we made this whole film without Norman in it. We weren't allowed to interview him. We had made the film. It was finished. And basically, it was a story being told by two groups of people, people who were for him and people who were against him. And, you know, hopefully I've succeeded in leaving you to make up your own mind how you feel about him. And I think the evidence we're getting back is that people are very mixed on how they feel about Norman. Some people love him and some people hate him. And a little bit for me, it's a little bit of a decoy. I'm very practical. And in the end, you wonder, well, do I have to love this guy? I don't think that's all that relevant. I think what's relevant is he going to be a danger to society when he gets out? Has he served his time? Has he been rehabilitated? I mean, as Carla Geramini in the film says, who was the head of the prison school, ultimately, you're going to get these guys back. Ultimately, they're going to be back out on the street. In Norman's case, he did it by releasing himself from prison, but he was out for 20 years. And what you want to do is you want to get people who are going to be good contributing members of society. And, you know, some of these guys should never be let out. They're very scary people, and they should be locked away from society. And I think it's up to the prison officials who work them every day to decide. And in Porter's case, they'd ruled twice that he should be let out, that he was no longer a danger to society. And it was funny. In the interview, he said to us, I had to escape from prison in order to prove that I didn't belong in prison.
Can he get another chance?
He was just informed that they miscalculated, and actually he won't be having a parole hearing until 2010. So now he's got two back-to-back life sentences to serve, and he has 3 years to serve for the escape.
Susan Gray, thanks very much for speaking with us.
And thank you for having me.